All right, so last time we talked about motion in the Bimini Statute of Plan First with motion extension, horizontal axis. We did abduction and adduction versus frontal plane, anterior posterior axis. And so now introducing the idea of the whole rotation type of deal to where we have like rotation like nose. The motion that we do is we're going to nod our head or shake our head nose. Side to side type of rotation. Left to right type of rotation with the torso, the vertical column. We can also have medial and lateral rotation or internal and external rotation of our ball and socket joints. And so when you see medial rotation, this is also called internal rotation. So if you think about your shoulder joint, your hip joint, internal rotation basically is you're from the anatomical position, you're rotating that joint internally or towards the midline of your body, right? And then external rotation or lateral rotation is you take the same joint and then you're rotating like outwardly or laterally, externally. And both of these guys, if you think about a vertical axis going through the long axis of that bone, like the humerus is swiveling about that axis, then this is going to be a horizontal plane type of movement or transverse plane type of movement with a vertical axis, or I also call them longitudinal axis. Okay. But all of these guys, the axis is going basically straight up and down the pole, and then you're sort of just swiveling about that axis. Okay. So another type of rotation, which really isn't a rotation, it's sort of a pivoting, if you will. So if you have this pivot joint, between the ulna and the radius. But for simplicity purposes, we're going to throw it into the rotation category. And so special movement of the radial ulnar joint is what we call pronation and supination. Okay, so pronation basically, if you just sort of, you know, hold your hand out in front of you, you can kind of pivot that radial ulnar joint with supination and pronation. So pronation basically would be where you turn the hand downward, right? In the anatomical position, that would be facing your palms backward, right? And then you can supinate by rotating in the opposite direction. Okay. Or you can hold the ball in the supinated position. So that's the supinated position of that radial ulnar joint. And we throw this one into the whole rotation, sort of vertical axis, horizontal plane, just because it doesn't really fit anywhere else. But when we talk about the pivot joint, the distinction between normal, just sort of, you know, internal and external rotation versus pronation and supination is that the radial head literally swivels in place like a little doorknob, right? But the shaft of the bone gets pulled across the ulna. Okay, so when you actually look at it, I mean, you can basically palpate your radial head back over here, and it swivels in place as you pronate, and so it turns, but then the shaft of the radius gets pulled, and so if my right arm represents the radius and my left arm represents the ulna, the radial head swivels in place, but the distal end of the bone crosses over the ulna. So in the pronated position, when your hand kind of goes down like that, the radius crosses, and in the anatomical position, those two bones are side by side. They're parallel to each other. So pronated, basically they cross and then they come back to a supinated position, side by side, parallel kind of stuff, in the anatomical position. And I think I found a video. I'll show you a couple of like simulations types of videos of almost all of these motions a little bit later. So pronated here, you can see this sort of crisscross. Anatomical position where your hand is supinated, or your radial ulnar joint is supinated, those two bones are side by side. So the radius comes out on the thumb side, and all that comes out on the pinky side, crisscrossed in that pronated position. But still, we throw it in just for simplicity purposes with that horizontal plane movement, along with the other rotations. Okay. When we look at the jaw motion and the scapular motion, we come across more what I refer to as translational, kind of sliding types of movements. Okay, so where they're really not spinning around and moving and stuff. And they're not really pivoting about some axis, or really rotating about an axis, right? Because your jaw is not really a hinge joint. I mean, there's condyles. But, you know, we open our mouth, and instead of it just sort of falling like a hinge, it actually drops, right? So we have, so we can go side to side on the jaw as well. So we get a lot of movement with our jaw. Okay? But they're all more sliding or translational types of movements rather than rotation. So we throw these guys in just with the motions, okay? So elevation, moving up or in a superior direction, shrugging your shoulders up, your scapula rise up in your back, dropping your jaw, depression, dropping your shoulders down, depression. So those sliding types of motions are associated with the movement of the mandible and also the movements of the scapula. And so scapular movement is a lot more versatile, really, than the mandible movement. But still, shrugging your shoulders up, they kind of slide up. Dropping your shoulders down is depression. But the shoulders also, if you think about where that humeral head goes, the scapula puts it there. Right? So if we're actually sort of, this one's going to be protraction. I can't scan these pictures. You can't even tell what it's doing. But when you pinch your shoulder blades together in the back, that's also called retraction. Okay. And then when we move our shoulders forward, like in a catch position for rowing and stuff, that's more of a protracted position. Retraction is bringing the back together, pinching them together in the butt. And then they also upwardly rotate when you think about the scapula in your back. I'm going to reach up, and that glenoid fossa is going to rotate kind of upward. That's actually called an upward rotation, and then there's also a downward rotation. So it actually moves kind of, it still translates in the back relative to the body's axis. You could consider like the protraction and retraction as rotations in that horizontal plane as well. And then you can consider the upward rotation and the downward rotation of the scapula in the frontal plane. But it's still kind of a lot of translation going on there. So protraction and retraction specifically. Protraction is when you're going to move forward or anteriorly. Retraction is pulling back. So when the jaw does it, you can see this is much more kind of translation. Shoving it up forward, pulling back. And then protraction and retraction of the scapula literally are kind of, I mean, your ribs are in the way. Your thoracic cage is in the way, so it can't just translate forward. So it kind of has to go around your ribs. That's what the scapula has to do. So it's a little bit more of a rotation. It kind of freaks me out when people walk in the door. So this is kind of the idea between protraction and retraction. So again, the scapula kind of hang out sort of on your back, and it has that little glenoid fossa. So it has to wrap around your thoracic cage. So it rotates somewhat in order to allow you to reach your arm forward. Because the scapula's job is to hold on to the humerus, right? So wherever the humerus goes, that's where my scapula is going to go. It's like this big catch type of thing. I got to hold on to the scapula. Reach forward, it's going to protract, pull back, it's going to retract. Those might be rotations. And then also, you think about upward rotation and downward rotation. Some books will also call that abduction and adduction, because that lower end, those sternal angles at the bottom, they will kind of rotate outward, which means that's kind of an abduction type of motion, and then you consider adduction. So there's different terminology with the whole abduction, adduction, upward rotation, downward rotation, but you get the idea. The scapula translates all over the place. Okay. I consider them more translational types of things. Some people consider them rotations of the scapula. Just to put it out there for knowledge, right? So when you get into another class, like biomechanics or something, and they talk about scapular motion, they may call it rotation because they have to account for the change in angle that the scapula make with the body's axis. Okay, so yeah, flexion, extension, sagittal plane, examples of joints that make sagittal plane motion, any kind of flexion, extension, so elbow, knee, hip, shoulder, whatever, ankle. Plantar flexion and dorsiflexion is specific to the ankle, right? Still sagittal plane motion. And plantar flexion and dorsiflexion, the ankle is the only joint that makes those motions. And then neutral, basically, is when you're just standing still. So you have 0 degrees. tiptoes, dorsiflexion, pulling your toe box off the ground, keep your heel on the floor. Lateral flexion, I like to call bending, like, because I like to keep flexion in the sagittal plane. So I'll use the word lateral bending most of the time, but lateral flexion, you're basically just bending to the side. Frontal plane motion, abduction, adduction, also frontal plane motion, abduction, abduction, away from the body, segments away from the body, and then abduction, they're bringing them back. Frontal plane motion, fingers, metacarpal plangeal joints, they can do this as well. Where your fingers are together, this is an adducted position, away, spread out, abducted. Medial and lateral rotation, these are going to be occurring with your ball and socket joints. So your hip and your knee primarily. So medial internal rotation, inward rotation, and then lateral or external rotation. Same plane, horizontal plane, transverse axis or longitudinal axis. Vertical axis maybe also. Pronation and supination is thrown in with that rotation as well. So pronation basically palm down or palm back, or supination, palm up or palm forward. And then we have these translations that go on with the mandible and then also with the scapula. Okay. So the movements of the skeleton are created by muscles, right? So if you have a voluntary movement at a joint, there's a muscle that attaches to the skeleton that moves that bone in that direction, okay? And the one thing you have to remember is that muscles don't push on bones, right? You might push on a wall, but your muscles are acting on the bones, and all muscles can do, you know, is contract. When they contract, they shorten, and when they shorten, they pull on the bone that they're attached to. So if you're going to move your forearm segment, you have to have a muscle and tendon that attaches to that bone. And then the motion basically is going to occur moving that segment, and it's going to then move in a direction that's kind of compliant with the joint. So you think about the axis, it's like the axle of the wheel, and then the bone moves like the spokes on a wheel, and pivots or rotates about that axis. Okay. So remember, muscles pull. That's all they do. And so if you have one muscle that flexes the elbow, you have to have another muscle that extends the elbow. Okay. And so thinking about a couple of joints, and then going specifically on how these guys are associated with the actual body joints. We have ball and socket joints. Typically, we think about the shoulder and the hip, right? You have a rounded head of the bone, and then you have like a socket. So when we talk about the shoulder joint, you have a small socket and a relatively larger head, right? And then the hip, you have a nice rounded head that fits all the way in the socket. But they both will provide the same general types of motion, right? Flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, internal and external rotation. And then we have hinge joints. The only true hinge joint, your book calls it the elbow joint, but again, there's two joints in your elbow. Typically when we talk about the elbow joint, what we're talking about is the humeral ulnar joint, okay? The articulation between the humerus and the ulna. And so when you look at that structure, you can see, oh, here's the center of my axis. And then I have this nice little wrench that's my ulna kind of pivoting and swiveling around that axis. So it's a nice hinge joint, right? Your book also throws in the knee joint, the ankle joint, and then also the interphalangeal joints in there as well. But we all know from looking at the skeleton, those joints don't really behave exactly like a hinge joint. They behave quite a bit differently. But the general motion of the segments can be associated with simple hinging, kind of flexion and extension, like a door thing. But it's because of those other structures in there. Okay, so thinking about how much movement is allowed, we're going to talk about our two ball and socket joints. We'll start with the shoulder. So within this shoulder, it's called the glenohumeral joint. And so why is it called the glenohumeral joint? Okay, so you got the humerus, humeral, right? Gleno is associated with the glenoid fossa or the glenoid cavity on the scapula. Okay. So hence, that's its name. So those are the two points. articulation between the humerus and the scapula, and it is triaxial. Okay? You have flexion and extension, you have abduction and adduction, and you have internal and external rotation. So all of your ball and socket joints are going to be triaxial. Because you have so little kind of bone-to-bone contact between the humerus and the scapula, you have to have a bunch of other structures to hold that joint together. Okay. And then the socket itself can move around too because the scapula isn't locked down. So this is our ball, this is our first ball and socket joint. The other ball and socket joint is your hip. And so we'll kind of compare and contrast those two ball and socket joints. So because you have such distance between the humerus and the axial skeleton, we talked about this before, we're going to attach to the scapula. Scapula is free to translate in the back, but it is attached into the clavicle, which is not exactly a rigid structure, because it comes down and the only point of attachment it makes with the axial skeleton is at that sternoclavicular joint. And it's right here in the front of your chest. So because we have all of this extra motion, it's not the most stable joint in the body, right? It is capable of huge range of motion, right? We can abduct all the way to where we put our arm over our head, and then we can actually adduct and hyperadduct and actually take our shoulder past vertical with our body, right? So it's a very complex joint, and because it's so complex, when we start looking at the structures that hold it together, we have a lot of little structures to increase contact and fit between the humerus and the scapula. So it's basically designed for mobility. It's not very stable. And so then when we start looking at these structures, within the humeral head is basically covered by articular cartilage, right? And then we have some extra ligaments and cartilage around that joint to increase kind of the fit and the touch in between the scapula and the humerus. And then we also have these extra ligaments holding together the clavicle and the scapula, right? And so this is a good example, an indication of how less stable this ball and socket joint is because when you look at the names of the ligaments up and around the clavicle and the scapula, you can see the acromioclavicular ligament. You will see the coracoacromial ligament. You will see the coracoclavicular ligament. And so these guys, all of these ligaments basically hold together just the scapula and the clavicle. But here's one of them that I was just kind of laugh at, is this coracoacromial ligament. What bones does that ligament hold together? Scapula. So that's how flimsy this joint is. You literally have ligaments holding together those two little processes that are part of the same bone. Okay? That's how flexible your shoulder is. Because you can actually get movement between these two processes. Okay? So that ligament is there to kind of limit the bending, the separation that those two bony processes actually undergo. Okay, so, and also it kind of provides a little bit of a soft bound, like a little rubber band, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to prevent, you put like a string or some type of piece of elastic or something covering the mattress that is in the back of your car, and you get a really flimsy bungee cord. Well, the flimsy bungee cord is going to flop up, mattresses can go flying when you're driving down the road. Same kind of thing would happen here if you get some separation and some sprains or strains in these ligaments, okay, so you get a little more give there. If you have a lot of give here, you're very likely to actually have some dislocation issues. Okay, but we have all kinds of stuff. We also have a set of muscles whose sole responsibility is holding on to the humerus. Okay. We call those guys rotator cuff muscles. We have four rotator cuff muscles. You learn them in lab as the rotator cuff tendons, but remember, tendons attach bone to muscle. Right, or muscle to bone, whichever way you want to look at it. And so the tendons that you're identifying basically lead into muscle. And they're named basically for the muscles. And so the muscles of the rotator cuff basically are supraspinatus, infraspinatus, and teres minor. These guys are all on the posterior of the scapula, and they will all attach onto the humerus. And then we have a subscapularis, which is actually on the anterior of the scapula, and it attaches in onto the anterior of the humerus. Okay. So these guys have slightly different functions, but they're all responsible for literally stabilizing the shoulder, right, and then rotating it in a certain direction. So looking at these guys, the supraspinatus is up in that, it lies in that supraspinous fossa. Origin is along the medial border up here above the spine of the scapula. Comes across and it actually attaches on the top of the scapula near that greater tubercle. And it is actually an abductor of the shoulder. So it actually kind of helps with this abduction deal. These two, the infraspinatus and teres minor, these guys are also going to have origins along that medial border on the posterior. They come through the infraspinatus and that infraspinatus fossa. Comes across, both the teres minor and infraspinatus attach onto the posterior humerus. These guys are both external rotators. And then on the anterior, this is cut through the entire chest. And the anterior have this subscapularis and this subscapular fossa. Has its origins along the anterior medial border of the scapula. And then it comes out, bigger muscle generally than any of these other three. And then this attaches to the anterior of the shoulder here. This is an internal rotator. So three out of the four of these guys are rotators, internal, one internal, and then two external rotators. And then there's one that's supraspinatus is going to be an abductor. Okay. So these guys all basically, when they contract, they hold on to that humeral head and keep it in the socket. They are very small muscles compared to your big deltoid muscles and your pectoralis muscles. They're little muscles. So they are capable of boatloads of strength. Okay? So if you go out to the gym and you're like beefing up with every 50-pound weights and throwing them around and stuff like that, you're not exercising your rotator cuff muscles. If you want to exercise your rotator cuff muscles, these guys, they're type 1 fibers, meaning they're more postural endurance fibers. Lots of reps. They're not capable of a lot of strength, so hence you gotta go super light, meaning 5 pounds max. Okay, and you do some, you know, abduction, some scaption planes, maybe some front raises, lateral raises, external rotations, internal rotations. And you're exercising your rotator cuff muscles. But instead of doing 10 reps with lots of weight, you do 50 reps with like almost nothing. Okay, so that's why you'll see some people out in that gym with like bands, just TheraBand types of things, just doing like kind of fatiguing internal, external rotations. Simple stuff. But most people don't like to exercise because it takes time doing 30 to 50 reps on almost nothing, right? So lots of times they don't get exercise. But you know you might have a tear or some type of impingement in these muscles if you can lift a 50-pound, whatever, you can lift your gallon of milk, but when you reach for your phone, it'll like lock up on you. Or you'll feel this weakness or this pain up in your shoulder somewhere, depending on where it is. But you can isolate and test each one of these muscles. Okay, so shoulder joint, triaxial, right? That means we have flexion and extension, abduction and adduction, and medial and lateral rotation, or internal and external rotation. So this first time I introduce this slide is the only time I'm going to stop on this slide. You'll see very similar slides when we talk about hinge joints, when we talk about other triaxial joints, because it's exactly the same information. So once you get it, you copy it down from that same slide. So these are our three orthogonal planes. Okay, they're all 90 degrees to each other. So between these three planes, we cover the entire range of motion that's capable of any joint. Okay. And all triaxial joints will have these three planes of motion and axes available. And the cool thing about the shoulder joint is it can also kind of translate as the scapula translates, because that's where your socket. two joints at the elbow, so this is where I kind of will part company with what the book says specifically. I'm not arguing that the elbow is not a hinge joint. It's just I'm going to specify that the humeral ulnar joint is a hinge joint. Okay. And it's a big articulation between the humerus, obviously, and its trochlea and the ulna. We get flexion and extension. And it's a great hinge joint. It even looks like a hinge joint, right? Can't go wrong with that. And again, to keep these two bones together, we have collateral ligaments. So think about lateral. Think about a joint. They lie on the lateral aspects of the joint on either side, right? Collateral. And so one of them is called like a medial collateral ligament, or in this case, when you're talking about the elbow, we're talking about the two bones that get connected, so there's a humeral ulnar kind of joint, or excuse me, ligament, ulnar collateral ligament. And then there's another ligament between the radius and the humerus, and that one's going to be called one of the lateral, or radial ulnar, or excuse me, radial collateral ligament. So when you see the names, you know, collateral is going to be on either side of the joint. And so these guys are going to hold it together. This is a medial view, meaning you're looking at the inside of your elbow. And then we have a radial ulnar joint. This is the articulation between the radius and the ulna. This is also at the elbow, right? This is what we call a pivot joint. This is what enables us to have pronation and supination. So pronation and supination. So when you're twisting some type of an on and off type of rotation type of deal, turning a doorknob. Supination is when you're going to bring the palm of the hand upward as if you are holding a bowl of soup. Pronation would be putting it downward. Anatomical position, supination is palms forward, palms backward, or posterior is going to be the pronated position. And so on this one, you can see, here's your radial collateral ligament. In this illustration, this is kind of, when this is the position that this elbow is in, so you can see both the ulna and the radius. They're actually already halfway pronated, okay? So that you can see the radius and then the ulna kind of underneath it, right? So in that partially pronated position, you can also see that this collateral ligament is already kind of twisted, okay? So when you start looking at the pronated position versus the supinated position, in the pronated position, that ligament continues to twist, right? So like you get a ribbon, and then you rotate one side of the ribbon, it gets a twist in the ribbon. So you'll see a lot of ligaments like this in the body where you get sort of a rotation or a spinning of one bone next to the other bone. When we look at the ACL and the PCL, they're actually created, but there's two, what they call that kind of banded ligaments that are together in the ACL and the PCL, and they're already twisted. Okay? So that way, that allows for that subtle rotation. Okay, but it holds everything together. All right, so moving to the hip, another ball and socket joint. This is the articulation between the femur, or the femoral head, and the acetabulum, which is of like the pelvic groove. So this is another triaxial joint. It also will have flexion, extension, and abduction, and adduction, internal and external rotation. The biggest difference here, though, is you think about motion of your hip compared to motion of your shoulder. We have a lot more flexion and extension and abduction and adduction and stuff in our shoulder. We have the same motions, but not as much at our hip. So we say that it has the same triaxial kind of motion, but shorter range of motion, a little more limited range of motion. Okay. So the range, basically. How far can you flex it and extend or abduct? And it's more limited, mostly just because of the huge bony contact, and we have some super strong ligaments in here and some super strong muscles that are going to keep that joint pretty well in place. And that proximal bones, not rotating all over the place, keeping up with the femur. It's pretty well locked into the axial skeleton at that sacroiliac joint. Okay. And we stand on our legs, right? So we're loading it, we're packing it tight. So it's very stable, less mobile, but it still has the same degrees of freedom or motion pairs that the shoulder has. The names of the ligaments on this are also associated with the bones that are connected. So we have a pubofemoral ligament, we have an ischiofemoral ligament, and we have an iliofemoral ligament. And that's because, remember, at that acetabulum, you'll see portions of all three bones as they fuse together. And so we have these large ligaments that are going to hold on to that femur and kind of help hold it into the socket. And you'll see that none of them are like straight, like from straight one point to the next one. They're all kind of curved around that femoral neck. Again, to allow motion, but yet stabilize it and limit that motion to keep that femoral head in the socket. And because they're such an awesome bony fit, if your leg gets pulled, the chances of it maybe harming the ligaments or maybe some musculature that surrounds the joint is higher than a dislocation. Something pulls on your shoulder, if you land on your shoulder funny, pretty easy to dislocate. Okay, all you have to do is basically dive for a ball or dive for a base like Superman. Come on out, you contact your shoulder, your torso region just a little bit wrong, that humerus is going to pop right out of socket. Okay? And there's not a lot saving, except for that little, you know, coracoacromial ligament, like, it's gone. The hip, and even then, when you dislocate the shoulder, you're going to hear a pop because that capsule got dislodged, okay? That fluid-filled capsule, like a suction cup. But you think about the femoral head and that acetabulum, that whole area is going to be full of fluid. You have extra bursa and labrum around this area. This is a weight-bearing bone joint. Plus, you have these massive ligaments. When this sucker pops out, it's like a cannon going off. And it is very, very loud because there will just be people in the gym like they weren't even paying attention. Like, what was that? Because they'll hear it, and it pops. Not just like a little Nerf gun. That'll be like what a shoulder sounds like. But a pop with a hit sounds like somebody hit a drum. Like, what was that? And people won't know if they weren't paying attention. But huge suction, weight-bearing, so hence it's even packed in and compressed even more. Very, very strong joint. Look, it's exactly the same size. Triaxial flexion extension, sagittal plane, abductor lat, frontal plane, medial, lateral rotation, transverse plane. Same exact triaxial joint. Okay, so looking at these joint motion videos, a lot of these things are simulations, and by simulations, they're all kind of inherently flawed a little bit, but it gives you a good visual because they have to restrict certain motion that normally would be going on. They have to simplify stuff so they can make the animation quick, that kind of stuff. But you'll see that it gives you a good indication of at least what is going on after we watch these awesome ads. Can I skip the ad yet? There you go. All right, so this. So I'm going to bash that up real quick. I did pause it, dude. Really? Yeah. Okay. So again, on this illustration, scapula is rigid, it's fixed. Okay, so it's not moving around. So normally when we move our shoulder around, the scapula moves a little bit with it. So this is with a rigid or a fixed scapula. And here's your clavicle, and this process is a little bit exaggerated based on the size of the scapula. But anyway, you get the idea. So the first thing they're going to do is flexion and extension. And so you can see that humeral head has a great range of motion. Here's internal rotation. You have a little bit of external rotation. Here's abduction and then adduction. Again, typically, got past it. But typically, when we actually, when sacrum, we can abduct to horizontal without much scapular motion, okay? But if you want to go above it, that scapula has to upwardly rotate or abduct some in the back in order for us to reach above our head, because the scapula, the glenohumeral is like right here. So horizontal, it doesn't have to move. But if I'm going to come up above, you saw that humeral head, it has those edges that are pretty rough. So you don't want them scraping up against the labrum and the other types of soft tissue structures in your shoulder, because that can like really hurt. And then later on, when we talk about the muscles, I'm going to talk about the unfortunate residence of one of the heads of your bicep tendon, because it's right there on that superior rim of the glenoid fascia as well. Let's just close that. I wanted to catch it though, so hang on a second. I don't know how else to like back up these things. So here it is again. You see the motion. Basically, where the greater tubercle is here, and then also where the, and this is really smooth humerus. Your humerus really isn't that smooth. But when we get an abduction, oh, I know why I couldn't pause it, because this stupid thing's blocked. Okay. But when the abduction, you can see that anatomical neck kind of creeping in and it's wanting to scrape those soft tissue structures. From the shoulder down now to the elbow and the wrist. Simple flexion and extension. Can't I just get rid of that permanently? Seriously, you know, it's like, okay, I told you to get rid of it. Come back again. So in flexion and extension, here's a fully flexed one. So you can see the humeral arm joint, and it's basically kind of rotating in that trochlea, just like a wrench does around a nut or a ball. And then the radial head, you remember that capitulum of the humerus? It's kind of hanging out there, and if you look at the top of the radius on top of that radial head, it's kind of got a little bit of a basin in it, and that basin basically articulates with that capitulum. So that's why you can see it right in there, and it's just kind of right, going for the ride, basically. So there's flexion, and then extension, straightening back out again. There's your wrist flexion. They had extension on it before, but getting ready to stick a needle in that right here, so I'll save you for that. Hip joint. And the hip, again, is a ball and socket joint, just like, there it is. I didn't watch it. Back rubbers. So here we're gonna go through flexion and extension. But you can see that the articular surface of the femoral head and the acetabulum, you don't really get into that bumpy area on the outside of that femoral head. Okay. And here's basically your abduction, and then you got adduction. We'll get to the knee in a second. Here's your radial ulnar joint, and tickle a little bit. So, 0.45. Half a pass forward this line. Talking right now. There's the pronation position. throw pronation and supination in that longitudinal axis. Loads of simpler. And so with the neck and the torso, again, we get those rotations, we get the bending, flexions, and extensions. There's flexion of the neck, cervical vertebrae extension, lateral bending to either side. There's your rotation, right rotation and left rotation. Back up one. So again, when you look about, when you think about flexion and extension, one of the things you remember with the vertebral column, you're not going to get a whole lot of flexion and extension between C3 and C4. Okay? You'll have very little movement between those two. But when you go all the way from C1 all the way down to C7, the angle between these guys ends up being a decent range of motion. Okay? Due to the relative angle change between the two. And same thing goes on with the lumbar vertebra, which is where we have our other huge range of motion. And same thing goes on here. When you think about lateral bending, right? You get some separation and movement, flexion, and kind of lateral bending and flexion between, angle change between adjacent vertebrae, like C5 and C6. But you get a huge range of motion difference between C1 and C7. So that's where we get a lot of our range of motion from. It's not between adjacent vertebrae, it's between an entire section from top to bottom. Same thing with rotation. Because those vertebrae house the spinal cord, we can't get a whole lot of relative movement between them because it'll just sever the spinal cord almost instantly. Let's skip that one and see what's next. Yeah, so this is the bending, and this is a really stiff model, I'm just telling you. Because we have a whole lot more lateral bending with the lumbar vertebrae than this. Okay, but you get the idea. Even with this stiff model, there's still a 30 or 40 degree rotation to either side. But that gives you the idea where everything kind of stays together. That's a meaty spot. We're not there yet. Okay, the last one I'm going to show you is the knee. So here's your flexion and extension. So you see what I'm saying? It's not a hinge joint, right? It's not a hinge joint. You get this huge translation between the tibia and the femoral condyles. The patella, you'll notice, stays out front. It stays on the patellar surface of the femur. It does not articulate with the tibia unless you dislocate it, in which case it will articulate with the tibia and the femur, and it's kind of uncomfortable. So, and it's held in place because it is literally inside that what we call quadriceps tendon or patellar tendon. And so it's basically held in place, so it's held into the face of the femur. So as you flex and extend, we got muscles that are going to pull that tibia back. I'm not sure. It just makes you feel bad. So anyway, you can see that patella tendon and those musculature is holding that patella tight into the face of the femur. And that way, it kind of stays put there. And then our femur moves kind of underneath it. Right? And that's why it slides and glides in that joint. Okay, so moving to the knee joint, which is why I say knee for last. You've got two joints there as well. You have the big one where we see most of our movement, and that's the interesting one when we talk about, you know, mechanics and stuff of movement, performance and stuff. We have the tibiofemoral joint. So this is going to be the joint between the tibia and the femur. And then we have the patellofemoral joint, which is going to be the articulation between the patella and the femur. Okay. So again, knee, I consider it triaxial. Almost every book that's around, except for a biomechanics book, is going to consider it a hinge joint, which is ridiculous. But whatever, you know. So obviously there's disagreement between biologists and anatomists versus sensible, mechanical, intelligent biomechanics type of people like myself. So anyway, but this is going to be formed between the condyles and the femur. And so this top picture here is literally a wide open knee joint. to where you're seeing the inferior surface of the femur, and you see all that nice slick condyle, the articular cartilage here, and it sits atop that tibia in that tibial plateau, which is like a little basin. And in this open, wide open position, you can also see these meniscus. So the meniscus, really, that's that additional accessory cartilage type of stuff. This is going to be fibrocartilage. And they're, each of them is like a crescent type of shaped cartilage disc. And so again, when you think about those femoral condyles, it's kind of round. And then the tibial plateau is kind of like a basin. So these are like sticking two little crescent-shaped pillows in between those two structures to sort of, again, improve the fit and to fill in the space between, you know, you have a bone, one bone coming together and then sitting on this surface. Well, there's going to be gaps, right? So these meniscus help fill in those gaps a little bit and improve the fit, so to speak. But they also provide shock absorption because they're kind of cushy. So on this open anterior one, you're going to have the lateral meniscus be on the fibular side, and then the medial meniscus will be on the tibial side, no fibula, right? You can see them pretty well from the front, anterior, just looking at the knee. And then this is a posterior view on the bottom. So here you're also going to have a medial meniscus, and then there you're going to have your lateral meniscus. But again, from a closed pack, like extended knee position like you're going to see on the bottom, you're going to still see it keeps those two bones separate. Okay, even in a dissected cadaver. In addition, we have ligaments that are going to hold that joint together. We have two cruciate ligaments. The cruciate means crossed. And so we have an anterior cruciate ligament, and we have a posterior cruciate ligament. You can see them both from the front of the knee, of an open knee like this. The anterior cruciate ligament has an anterior attachment on the tibia. And then it goes up and into that intercondylar notch and attaches more posterior into that notch in the femur. The posterior cruciate ligament, you can see the anterior section of it right here in the top illustration. But most importantly, it's going to have its origin there and attachment side, the posterior of that tibial plateau. And then the anterior attachment is in the anterior region of that intercondylar notch on the femur. So literally the two ligaments inside that knee joint literally crisscross, right, in space. So anterior cruciate ligament has an anterior attachment on the tibia. Posterior cruciate ligament has a posterior attachment on the tibia. Okay? And then literally they kind of go up into space and they attach onto the femur. Inside of that intercondylar notch. So these guys are what we call intrinsic or intracapsular ligaments. So if you have your joint capsule of a synovial joint, these guys are inside that capsule. Okay. So they're surrounded by the synovial fluid and they're in there. So if you have issues with your meniscus or if you have junk floating around inside of your joint space, the ACL and the PCL are directly exposed to that stuff. So those are intracapsular ligaments, and they crisscross. And I'm going to show you another illustration in just a second that I found that kind of helps clarify their functions. So those cruciate ligaments kind of help, one, they hold the two bones together, but then also, because they crisscross anterior to posterior, they kind of prevent the forward and backward translation difference between those two bones as well. The collateral ligaments, just like the radial and the ulnar collateral ligaments on the elbow, collateral, they're on outsides, each side of the butt of the joint. You're going to have a medial collateral ligament and a lateral collateral ligament. So on this top illustration, the lateral collateral ligament is also called the fibular collateral ligament because it's basically on the lateral side. It attaches basically on the fibula, and then it also attaches onto those epicondyles of the femur. And then the medial collateral ligament is also called the tibial collateral ligament. It attaches basically the tibia and the femur on the medial side of the knee. Okay? So if you think about sandwiching the knee on either side, if you think about abduction or adduction of the tibia relative to the femur, so abduction would be kind of like the flaying of the lower leg outward. Adduction would be kind of movement of that lower leg inward relative to the knee. these guys on the left PC, or excuse me, the LCL and the MCL, those guys are there to help limit that load. Okay. So remember, ligaments limit movement. Okay. So if you have a lateral collateral ligament out here, if the tibia goes inward, it's going to stretch that lateral collateral ligament. So abduction, or excuse me, adduction of the tibia is going to be the movement that the MCL resists or limits. The medial collateral ligament, if you were to flay your tibia outward, that medial collateral ligament will get stretched. And so it's there to limit that abduction kind of motion of the tibia. You see what I'm saying? So the ligaments limit movement. So they're there to basically support and stabilize the knee joint passively. So that's where our abduction and adduction deals go. And then we have the patellar ligament, or the patellar tendon, associated with that patellofemoral joint. And so the patella hangs out in the front of the femur. And then, so there's also a ligament that goes from the patella down to the tibia, which is going to kind of, again, sort of enhance some support towards the anterior of that joint as well. And it basically keeps things together when we talk about going into full flexion and then into full extension. Because that tendon remains taut, and it kind of keeps that anterior portion of the tibia pulled into the femur. And so now we'll show you some other pictures. So on this one, this is the top illustration is associated with the function, if you will, of the ACL and the PCL. So the top one is going to be our ACL. So the ACL literally goes from that posterior aspect of the femur, comes down through that intercondylar notch, and attaches onto the anterior of the tibia. So if I were to push the tibia forward, right, then that would stress the ACL. So that's the movement that it is designed to resist, structured to resist. Likewise, if I were to shove in a pack, what we call a closed pack position, like a weight bearing position, if I were to push the femur back relative to the tibia, that would also stress the ACL, right? Because it's going along that direction. Okay? So you move those two structures relative to each other, push the tibia forward relative to the femur, or push the femur back relative to the tibia. That's going to stress your ACL. So the ACL is there to limit that motion. PCL is down here on the bottom. PCL has more of an anterior attachment on the femur, comes back and has a posterior attachment on that tibial plateau. And so again, when the tibia is shoved backward relative to the femur, that's going to stress the PCL. Likewise, if the femur is shoved forward relative to the tibia, that will also stress the PCL. Okay? So it's designed to withstand that translation of the tibia, posterior translation of the tibia relative to the femur. So these guys literally, if you yank forward and backward on the knee joint like that, you're going to be, you can test kind of the integrity of those two ligaments, right? But collectively, again, they're like these little crisscross ligaments. So they'll hold the joint together. They allow for some rotation between those two bones. But this is their specific purpose, if you think of it like that. And so throwing the words out, open chain, closed chain, you'll get this in other classes if you take any kind of exercise classes or any kind of therapy types of classes. Open chain literally just means, hey, I'm doing like a leg curl kind of thing. My leg is sort of free, and I'm doing extensions of my knee, and I'm doing flexions of my knee. Those are open chain types of exercises. Closed chain types of exercises might be doing more like squats, wall sits, stuff like that, where you've literally compressed the joint because you're weight bearing. The one thing to remember, though, is that the knee joint is going to behave differently in those different positions. So kinematic chain, kinetic chain. Kinematic chain basically means we're basically linked segments, right? And it moves. The kinetic chain is associated with the forces that go through that kinematic arm. But it has to do more with the forces that are acting on the joints as well. Okay, so to show you some of the ACL, PCL types of deal, we'll do the Lachman test first. I guess I need some sound. Let me pause you, brother.
see you want your patient supine. Bring the knee in a 20 degrees of flexion. Both my right hand is on the femur stabilizing. My left hand is on our tibia. I'm not grabbing the knee joint, okay? Have it relax, and you just draw tibia forward towards you. It's almost this kind of an angle. So your hands, this hand is like your counterbalance, and the other hand is pulling tibia forward. And notice with Blair here, which is a positive blocking test.
In clinician speak, positive tests usually indicate something's wrong.
Or injured towards, right? I'll just show you her unaffected knee. This knee she did have previous surgery. So a little bit of play, but not nearly the same. Just show you again.
There's also this little thing that's called an infeo. And so an infeo basically means like if you've got a strap. If you have a strap or a cable, man, they tighten everything up. You can't play with nothing in here anymore. You can look, a free cable. If you have like a cable, I can get enough time. If you have a cable, like, and it's not taut, right? It's not providing any resistance until it becomes taut. Okay. So basically, you can tug on a cable and you'll feel an end. Like I can't. If I feel like there's an end there. There's a definite restraint now. Usually if you're doing a clinical test and you feel I have an infeel, so if you're pulling and you have a definite infeel, then usually the ligament is intact. It could be strained somewhat, but it's definitely still there, right? Whereas if you have an empty infeel, what that means is that there's, you're kind of tugging, and there's not any definite restraint going on there. So that's when they may have an empty infeel, right? Meaning that the ligament is probably completely gone, and there's other tissues that are restricting that motion, not the ACL. I'll put my prop back down. Okay, so that's kind of the way that one rolls. And this is really gross. It's not as bad as
speed.
I hope she's on drugs. Here comes. So that's kind of that rotation I was talking about. That's usually limited by the ACL and the PCL. You can see the patellar ligament is still there and intact, but the patellar actually is the patella itself. That's the abduction and adduction. And the thing was, I told you it was really messed up to begin with. They ain't gross, but you watched. I warn you, then you think, oh man, this is going to be disgusting. Yeah. There you go. It's not as bad as when, I mean, I can show you some really disgusting breaks of tip fin fractures and mixed martial arts guys. Okay, patellofemoral joint. Again, these are just exercises to enhance your knowledge. But from a sagittal plane kind of view here, the patella articulates with the femur and the femoral condyles, and it goes inside that little groove that is sort of within that patellar surface. And so it tracks nicely during full flexion here. Again, the combination of that patellar ligament and then the contraction of the quadriceps group up here, tugging it, it pulls it into femur. And then as we move into extension, it kind of actually glides up. But it's not like it gets pulled up. It just kind of stays sort of in place, a little bit more upward. But you'll see it tracks more to the anterior surface of the femur, okay? When we do like, you know, full extension and such like that. So it's tracked in there, and it glides along that patellar surface of the femur. And the other thing is because that groove is not exactly in the center of the patellar, surface, it's a little bit more, a little bit more lateral, but it's kind of held in place because there's four muscles that come in that quadriceps group, And each of them will actually have to share a kind of a tendonous attachment site in with the patella, because the patella is the sesamoid bone and goes inside that tendon. And so some of the musculature can pull, and ideally it's supposed to track inside that groove, right? But if you have kind of some anomalies and strength imbalances, and maybe your medial quadriceps are a little bit, like your medial vastus or your lateral vastus might be a little stronger. If the lateral vastus is a little stronger, it may actually pull the patella a little more laterally. So you might have more lateral tracking. As long as it's not causing any pain, it's usually not a big deal. But the more it kind of maltracts, the more it could actually dislocate in just normal movement. And most of the time, it's not an issue. But sometimes, knee joint kind of injuries and such like that vary quite a bit. So basically, that patella basically is pulled by four different muscles within that quadriceps group. They all come down and they share a common tendon. The tendon then goes on down and attaches to the tibia. So the patella basically, we say, is pulled by a quadriceps group. To figure out that angle of pull, scientists or anatomists, whatever you want to call them, they basically have figured out this measurement of what they call a Q angle, right? And so the Q angle is associated with determining the shaft, the angle, or the direction, I guess, if you can think of it that way, of the tibia. So if you take the patella and the tibial tuberosity, or the tibial tuberosity and kind of the midpoint between the malleoli and the ankle, find the shaft of the tibia, and then you want to find the angle of pull from the femur. So in order to get that angle, they're going to associate the ACIS, or that anterior superior linear spine, that point all the way down to where the patella is as well. So they get these two lines in space, and they measure the angle between them, right? And they call that the Q angle. So they associate that with the angle of pull that the quadriceps group is making on the patella, right? Which would affect knee position, right? And so some scientists, like Dr. Walter Schmidt, where we're going to watch his video here in just a minute, he associates that Q angle, wider Q angle, with a predisposition to ACL injury. Right? Make sense? Because this measurement, they found out a long time ago that in the United States, I'm wrong, in the United States, female athletes are more predisposed to ACL injuries, right? Compared to their male counterparts. And so what happened was, is there was this rush of research out into the performance industry to say, well, why is this happening, right? And so a bunch of scientists all went out there and they just started, you know, putting sticky bombs all over the place and measuring every possible thing that could possibly have to do with anything related to the knee. And they came up with this measurement, okay? And now think about this measurement. And then think about how, on average, which is what research and statistics is all about, right? Breaking the average, why this Q angle, on average, should be bigger than in females than it is in males. Wider hips. So just by the simple nature of being female, some researchers and trainers believe that the females are more predisposed to injury because of this Q angle, right? Do you see the inherent flaw in that association, right? Because there are boatloads of females that have never had a knee problem, never had an ACL injury, and they are high caliber professional athletes. What is it? Are their Q angles smaller? Or are they just an anomaly? Some freak of nature that you just didn't get an injury. But the interesting thing also is that this epidemic is a United States thing. It doesn't really happen as much in China and in Europe and in other types of continents and countries. Mostly because their athletes are well taken care of and trained from very young ages. They're targeted when they're little, and they're trained. So anyway, but I don't think they measure their Q angles when they're 10. So, you know, anyway, just throwing that out there. Think about some of these things that you come across, and don't just take them as facts, but question them. You can present the facts and still have your own opinion. So we're going to listen to Walter Schmidt just because he is very infatuated with his graduate students and model. Because you know he didn't do it just because of the way he's presented to it. Anyway, so here's Walter.
So let's look at some movement of the knee. Here's the medial collateral ligament. Plus the movement and flexion extension of the medial collateral ligament.
Medial collateral ligament is here. There's your patella ligament here. Patella is being trapped by muscles you can't see. Right.
Here's the lateral collateral ligament. And you can see that the movement of the femur on the tibia, and also look at the ligament being moving forward and back. And look at the whole movement of the whole joint here. You can also watch the patella and the patellar tendon. We'll just do that one again. Maybe watching the patella and the patellar tendon sliding in that fashion. See how the patella slides in the groove there, in their condylar space, in their condylar groove. Here we have the patella motion from above.
That's that tracking.
And flexion extension.
That's flexion.
And you can see it slides in and out of that groove. Normally, it should stay right in its intercondylar space. These are the primal pictures slides. Here we have what's called patellofemoral tracking. This is the tracking that should take place where that patella stays right in that groove in the intercondylar space. Here we see again patellar ligament, and we see the course of it tracking. Good again. And it should slide evenly and smoothly through that groove. And when sometimes there's an imbalance in the muscles, particularly the quadriceps vastus muscles, for the most part, it could be other muscles, but the vastus muscles, it will not slide in that groove and create a lot of pain as the patient flexes and extends their knee. Here's more tibial femoral motion. And you see the posterior collateral ligament and the anterior collateral ligament, posterior collateral ligament, anterior collateral ligament.
There's the ACL, and then there's the PCL, but it's the anterior cruciate ligament.
And here we see another one. These are so cool, I just thought put them all in.
That's
you can see the collateral ligaments.
Collateral ligaments are on
these
the outside.
These are the collateral ligament and the cruciate ligaments. I mean, I see the collateral and cruciate ligaments. I'm going to look at this one again. So the cruciate ligaments, anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments.
They're inside there. Those are your anterior capsules.
The lateral collateral ligament, the anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments firing.
So a good thing to see on this one, this is an anterior review of the knee as it's flexing. There's your ACL or your anterior cruciate ligament. Posterior cruciate ligament, you can sneak it up from behind. And it attaches to the anterior aspect. And now I think he goes on and talks about.
Okay. So with those in mind, then the patellofemoral stress syndrome.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, those are good kind of simulations and such like that. And this is basically, again, for your knowledge, this one on the next slide. This is really just to show you that the femur obviously attaches the hip to the knee, right? Your hip bone is connected to your leg bone. And then your leg bone is connected to your knee, which means the shape of the femur as it develops and as you grow and as you load it and whatnot, and then what you do to it, bone adapts to what you do. So as we go from infanthood to toddlerhood and then into young kind of pre-adolescence, that knee position that we can visibly see from the outside view we're looking at kids changes. And it changes primarily because the femur is growing through different stages of development as we grow and develop bone, and then also as we begin to crawl and then weight bear and then stand, locomote, and that kind of stuff. So little babies, all little babies are bow-legged. So, you know, cutie and their little round legs and stuff like that, standing, whatever, they got this little bow-legged leg, right? And so then, we don't worry about that because all babies are bow-legged, right? And then they kind of get into that whole 18, 30 months or whatever when they're actually kind of locomoting and kind of getting around and stuff like that. And then what happens is they get into that, I call it the Bambi years, where they're kind of growing legs. You're like, wow, where did those legs come from? But then their knees almost look like ball and socket joints, right? They're little rounded little bumpy, round knees that bend in almost every direction you can imagine. And so they're kind of not needed at age 3 and 4 and such. The thing is, though, is you won't see, unless it's excessive and it's actually demonstrated through x-rays and such, that there's an actual knee deformity at some point. Most of the time, they won't intervene with some type of orthotic, okay? Most of the time, they'll kind of let that play out a bit. And then by the time they're 8 to 10, their legs and their knees positions will actually straighten out some. If it remains, then they may think about some PT, maybe some strengthening and some different types of knee positions and strengthening, or maybe some ankle and foot orthotics to basically stabilize that ankle position to drive the tibias a little more outward, and hopefully the femur will comply and come outward as well and straighten the knees away. But the other thing is to remember that knee position you see is influencing the torsion or the twisting, if you will, of a bone. So if you take any structure and you load it in what's called torsion, that means you're wringing it like you're wringing the water out of a rock, okay? Your bones undergo that type of loading as well. So not just compression and not just tension, they undergo bending and they undergo torsion. So if you have a very odd foot position or ankle position, that's going to change the loading of that whole kinematic chain, okay? And so that's going to create torsion. So usually internal torsion on one bone ends up resulting in internal torsion on the other bone that lies below it. So that weird hip position could actually influence knee position, which could actually then influence loading. So just thinking about these things, not just one-dimensionally, but think about it as far as the whole body. Because oftentimes foot abnormalities will work their way up to where, oh, my shoulder and my neck are hurting when I walk. Well, that's because your feet are, your shoes are on the wrong feet. And you'll find that in seeing clinics. Anyway, so the torsion kind of thing is going to be associated with the angle of antepression. Anytime you want to talk about this, that's okay. But I wanted to show you kind of what happens beneath the surface, right? We see the terms genu, you associate genu with a knee. Coxa, associated with the coxal bones of the hip. Genu varus versus genu valgus have to do with that knock-kneed, bow-legged position. So in infants, it's one thing, but in adults, you'll see some, this is a normal knee position. When you look at the x-rays and such, normal. You'll see nice joint space between the tibia and the femur. When you have individuals that are bow-legged, you can see here now that the medial aspect of each one of the knees is a little more compressed. That's what's being created by that bow-legged position. And so when you look at it under x-rays, you'll see a thinning of the joint space on the medial aspect. But then the lateral aspect looks okay, right? It's still some good joint space. And then on the far right-hand picture, this is what we call genu valgus, or knock-kneed position. And so here then you see the opening of the joint space medially, and then more of a compression laterally. And when you look at it on the x-rays, you have like no joint space here medially, or excuse me, laterally. And then you're going to have some joint space, but actually probably thinning in the joint space here medially as well. But the one thing about these type of positions, this shows you for this genu varus, like a varus hip, had a good one. Advisor tell me that. Say, oh yeah, you can remember genu varus and the position, because if somebody rolls a ball to you and it goes between your leg and you look between your legs and you say varus and like varus the ball. That's your genu varus position. Just kind of. But that is going to say when you compress this medial compartment, you basically open it up like a little Pac-Man lateral compartment. These kinds of positions with the adduction of the tibia, this is going to be what's happening with this varus. Genu valgus, that's an abduction of the tibia relative to the knee. Anytime you get loading, like some helmet comes to the inside of the knee or some helmet comes to the outside of the knee, this is when we have multiple injuries that happen at the knee, right? On these guys, you might drive the tibia forward, hence your ACL gets blown out. You get this separation medially, like big Pac-Man happens at the joint. The medial meniscus can slip, right? And then additionally, that medial collateral ligament could get popped as well because it just got stretched. So you have a kind of the trifecta of knee injury, right? If you take a blow laterally, or if you take a blow medially to the knees, opposite kind of thing can happen as well. Okay, just thinking about things that go on three-dimensionally and why things happen and what those ligaments are for, okay? So that's So the knee, I consider it triaxial joint, but I disagree. Other people disagree. Some people call it a hinge joint, right? Just flexion and extension.